Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. What is the craziest thing you've done to treat yourself? Cut off a wart with a kitchen knife? Pull out a tooth that was hurting so bad with pliers? I put this question out on social media, and those are some of the things I heard back from you. Here's David Winston's story. Right after college, he was working on a movie, think super low budget. He was mostly doing menial tasks.
Telling people where to park, or asking them to be quiet because we're shooting, or asking them, please don't walk there, or mow your lawn later, please.
He was outside most of the day, and it rained a lot. He couldn't afford the gas to drive his car home, so he slept in it, often in wet clothes, for 2 weeks. The wet clothes were rubbing up against his skin, and it started to break down.
Particularly my thighs had become chapped and raw, and eventually the skin broke, and I ended up with some pretty bad infections on a couple areas on my legs. I was making about 50 bucks a day. I didn't have any health insurance. I couldn't even afford to go see a doctor.
The infection got worse. Then David remembered that as a kid, he got tetracycline to treat a skin infection. It's an antibiotic.
I knew I couldn't get a prescription for it, but I also knew that they sold it in pet stores to kill the bacteria in fish tanks. So I went to a pet store and I bought a bunch of tetracycline tablets. I had no idea of what dose to take or if the pet store version was even safe for human consumption, so I opted to go with a poultice.
He mashed up the tablets, added water,
and then I put it directly into the open wounds.
And then he screamed.
It burned and it stung and it was awful. And I wrapped up my legs in toilet paper and walked around my apartment without pants for a week until it all scabbed over and got better.
He took a risk here. No doctor would recommend this. On today's episode, the things we'll do to treat ourselves. Why we do it. What are the harms? What are the payoffs? Americans love supplements, multivitamins, keratin, collagen, black cohosh, you name it. It's an almost $40 billion market in the U.S. Supplements are not heavily regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, but recently, one herbal supplement caught the agency's attention. It's called kratom, or some people say kratom, and the FDA has now classified it as an opioid, which could put kratom on a path toward becoming an illegal substance. That has caused a huge amount of backlash among devotees of the supplement, who say it helps them deal with depression, anxiety, and even addiction. They've collected thousands of signatures on petitions. They've unleashed their anger on Twitter and YouTube.
They're lying.
This is the biggest crock of crap I have ever seen.
Plain and simple, the FDA does not work for us.
There's a lobbying group dedicated to this cause. What is all this passion about? Liz Tung went to find out.
I started my journey with Sean, a local kratom enthusiast who lives on the outskirts of Philly. He asked that I not use his last name because kratom isn't legal everywhere, and Sean's had his own legal problems, which you'll hear about in a sec.
Okay, yeah. So.
I went to visit him at his cozy apartment.
Yeah, this is Megan, my girlfriend. Yeah. I don't know if you want to have a seat, yeah. Whatever you want to do.
It has tan carpeting, and it's filled with framed pictures and knickknacks.
Little kratom seedling that somebody drew for me, and it's got the hashtag kratom.
And over by the window is his pride and joy.
Yeah, this is my kratom plant right here, and you can see it's just starting to get the shiny green leaves on top. It looks like a plant, but it's actually a tree.
A tree from Southeast Asia, where for centuries, the leaves have been used in traditional medicine to treat pain, fever, and stomach problems. In small doses, it gives you energy. In larger doses, it relaxes you. Sean says for him, kratom does a little bit of both.
So I'm just going to open a bag. You can see.
It's this fine olive green powder, and it smells like green tea.
I'm just going to get my spoon over here.
He spoons out a mound on the table.
There's just so many little nuances to taking kratom and looking at it and smelling it.
He takes out what looks like a circle of cellophane.
They're actually rice paper. I don't know if you can...
So you're putting a little pile of it in the middle.
I'm putting a little pile of it in the middle, and normally I would use a scale because you always want to kind of take the same. And then you just fold it like this. You're actually making like a little sack. And then you'll just give it a tiny twist. And then you just take it and put it in your mouth.
He puts it on his tongue and takes a big gulp of water.
And that's it.
Sean calls kratom his vitamin.
For me, kratom is a daily thing, and it helps me maintain a healthy state of mind, and it helps me maintain my healthy habits.
For a long time, Sean was a heroin addict. He's been clean now for 4 years, but he's never forgotten what it feels like to take heroin.
Heroin, the only way I can describe it, it's like you're back in your mother's womb, or you're back in her arms, and you're in a swaddle, and you're warm. And nothing can hurt you, and you feel safe.
He first tried heroin at 19, and for the next 12 years, Sean cycled back and forth between using, jail, and attempts to get clean.
I spent over 4 years in and out of recovery houses on my own, just trying to find a way to stay sober and find a way to live like a normal human being.
It was really, really hard. Without heroin, Sean says he felt incomplete.
For a long time, I looked at other people who were just living their lives, and I was always jealous of that because I never felt like I could just be comfortable in my own skin.
In his early 30s, Sean got sent to prison for 5 years. It was the longest he'd ever been put away. When he got out in 2015, things started getting better. But staying sober was still a major struggle.
Just wanting to go and knowing that heroin is within a mile radius anywhere I go in Philadelphia.
Sean had a major relapse, and even after he got over the physical withdrawal, he couldn't quite kick his cravings. That's when Sean remembered something a friend told him about years ago, this herbal supplement called kratom that supposedly helped people get clean from heroin. He decided it was worth a try, so he went to his local head shop and picked some up.
I ended up getting a half ounce, and it was pretty nondescript. It said Kratom Therapy on it, and it had kind of like an RX symbol.
He got home, tried a little bit, then headed out for a walk. About 20 minutes later, he started feeling better. Not high, just better.
And it was a nice feeling. It wasn't overwhelming. There was nothing, no negative connotation to it. There was no needles or I didn't have to go cop it somewhere. It was a nice feeling. And I felt a little bit of hope that I wouldn't have to go back out there and do heroin again.
Stories like Sean's have been front and center in the fight to save kratom as the federal government considers a ban. The idea that an herb could treat opioid addiction and withdrawal symptoms has a lot of people excited. But the FDA says kratom isn't saving people from opioids. It is an opioid. Here's FDA head Scott Gottlieb.
We think this is a drug-like substance. We think it is an opioid analog in many respects.
The FDA based its conclusion on a computer model showing that kratom activates opioid receptors in the same way that drugs derived from morphine do. The agency wouldn't go on tape, but a spokeswoman I talked to says health officials are seriously worried about the potential for addiction and even death. Her exact quote, "Kratom is an opioid. We believe it behaves as an opioid and produces the same effects as an opioid. Just because it's a plant doesn't mean it's safe." But several of the scientists I've talked to disagree.
Their comments about kratom have been unscientific. They do not match the current science.
Mark Swager has done a few studies on kratom, though he emphasizes he's not on the payroll of any kratom lobbyist groups. And he says the FDA's conclusion is just plain wrong.
Kratom does not act on opioid receptors in the same way that classical opioids do. And so you don't get the same sort of respiratory depression and you don't get the same sort of euphoria.
Mark says there are dangers to kratom. He and other researchers say there's a real possibility of dependence, but they say overdoses are unlikely. The FDA, on the other hand, says the opposite. It's cited 44 deaths so far that it says resulted from kratom. But Oliver Grundman, a pharmacology researcher who's also an expert in forensic toxicology, says that claim doesn't really hold water.
in fact, actually 43 out of the 44 cases that the FDA cited were so-called poly substance or poly drug cases, where multiple substances in conjunction then led to the fatality.
Substances like antidepressants, benzodiazepines, alcohol, and opioids. 9 of the deaths were from Sweden. A doctor at the National Board of Forensic Medicine who investigated those deaths said none of them were due to kratom alone either.
If you ban kratom, people are going to die.
That's Dave Herman. He's the head of the American Kratom Association, which is the kratom movement's biggest lobbying group. And he says there's a bigger danger the federal government should be worrying about.
You're creating a black market. If you create a black market, you're now really open to adulterated products that could kill people. You're now also throwing them, those that don't want to participate in a black market, back into the opioid jungle, which will also kill people.
This claim has become a major talking point for kratom supporters, one that I heard several of the scientists I talked to repeat. But while researchers may be excited about kratom's potential, some doctors who treat opioid addiction are more cautious.
I would not recommend kratom as a therapeutic option.
Ingvild Olsen is an addiction specialist in Baltimore and also serves on the board of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Ingvild says the organization doesn't have an official stance, but that she and most of her colleagues are suspicious of kratom, along with other quote-unquote natural addiction treatments that haven't been vetted.
Kratom is not an FDA-approved medication, and so you really don't know what you're getting.
Either in terms of dosage or in terms of just general safety. In fact, a bunch of people were recently poisoned by batches of kratom that were tainted by salmonella. Her other big concern?
It can turn people away from evidence-based treatments. And the challenge with that is that, you know, we have good data that treatment with those medications really saves lives.
Ingvild's talking about drugs like methadone and Suboxone. But not everyone's willing to try those medicines. Sean, the former heroin user from Philadelphia, says he stayed away from them because of the stigma and side effects. He also just didn't want to go on another pharmaceutical. He liked the idea of treating himself, using something more natural. And at this point, he doesn't have any doubts about what kratom can do.
Kratom saved my life 100%. Without kratom, I don't believe I would be in the same place that I am now. I know I wouldn't.
Liz Tung reported this story. Some desperately ill patients who have run out of treatment options want to make one last effort to save their lives, and they end up fighting to get new drugs that are not on the market yet. These drugs haven't been tested or approved. That's at the heart of a big movement called Right to Try. It's backed by a lot of patients and politicians, but bioethicist Art Kaplan has a lot of concerns.
The first thing to think about is if it's very early in research, just tried on animals, or it's only been tried in a few human beings, we don't know what dose to give you. We don't even know how often to give it to you. We don't know what we're doing. A lot of companies are going to say, much higher chance that we'll kill you on the spot than you're going to get any benefit. Another reason to think, do I really want to do this, is cost. Some companies will say, yeah, you can try our experimental agent. We're a tiny company. It cost us $1 million to make this stuff, and we don't have much of it. If you want to try it, pay us. So you could have enormous cost burden thrust onto a family trying to crowdsource or do whatever they can to raise the money just to pay for their scarce supply of a drug. One other issue that confronts people who say, I want to try this is, if you try it and something goes wrong, you have no recourse.
Let's say you have a terrible reaction to a new untested drug and get even more sick. There's nobody to sue, no way to get your money back.
For example, if it's a quack who says, look, you have a terrible cancer. I made this stuff in the bathtub. I gave it to the cat and the cat did okay. So I'm going to sell it to you. You don't have any way to get back when that person harms you.
Despite these risks, most states have right-to-try legislation on the books, and President Trump just signed a federal bill into law.
Courageous families who have traveled from near and far, it is deeply humbling to join you here today as President Trump takes historic action to enshrine into American law the right to try.
But Art Kaplan says these laws, federal or state, do not really get new drugs to dying patients.
If you're going to get access to something, it's up to the company who owns the drug or the device or the vaccine to give it to you.
What are the risks for a drug company in this, and what are the potential rewards?
The risks to companies are if you start seeing adverse events, problems, deaths, difficulties, when you give it out compassionately, maybe the FDA, or more likely Wall Street, is going to say, we're not spending money on your drug. So bad news travels fast. And particularly on the investment side, you can lose support for drug innovation for something that might be promising just because you had a problem in a very sick person who tried it as a last-ditch, desperate measure. Benefits, well, it's good PR to be seen on the side of patients and say we're helping you get things. But again, the people are so sick who make these requests that it's pretty difficult to learn much about whether the drug is helping, because the hope that you could reverse the disease in a last-ditch effort is difficult to make come true.
These situations get really tricky. Here's an example. A few years ago, the Hardy family from Virginia launched a grassroots campaign. They were pressuring drug maker Shimerix to allow their dying son, Josh, to try one of the company's drugs that was still under development.
Where there's a will, there's a way. And our will is very strong, and we're going to keep on asking and asking and asking until they hear us. I know they hear us, but until they release it for us.
The drug maker finally agreed.
7-year-old Josh Hardy's gained national attention, and we learned tonight we'll be able to take the only drug that his family says could save his life.
This story has really gone viral. People from all over the country have reached out to the family, and their friends tell me it was that support that made the president of the company change his mind.
It was a drug called brincenofovir, by the way, used also in people who were exposed to Ebola as an experimental agent there. Some of those doctors who came back were given this antiviral drug.
Josh got better at first, but then he died a year later. And the company's stock plummeted by 80%. So these are the risks that these companies are trying to weigh. Art Kaplan recently put together an advisory committee to help one drug company do this better.
Well, we've got to try to make it easier for companies to give out drugs. So I formed, in conjunction with Johnson & Johnson, a committee to advise them or help them make decisions about giving out an experimental drug. The one we picked was for multiple myeloma, and they had a drug that was looking promising but not yet approved. And we said, take it to our committee. We'll advise you about whether people should get it or not. It'll make you more comfortable as a company in deciding to give it. And in fact, we've managed to give out hundreds of cases of giving people that drug, whereas Right to Try has achieved nothing.
In summary, how would you sort of phrase an ideal way to legislate people's right to try?
I think Right to Try is empty rhetoric that politicians adopt who don't understand the nature of the problem. But I fully support patients having access. What you need to do is help them find out what drugs are out there. The Right to Try laws don't do that. You need a doctor who's well-informed and good databases to know, where am I looking? You need to make sure that the committees are there to agitate and argue for access when sometimes the company might be nervous or balky or worried about that. There are many steps, including cost, that could be taken to help give people who are desperately ill a reasonable last shot. Unfortunately, the way the legislation is proceeded at the state and federal level, it doesn't do what I think many people would like to see done, give people, you know, some access, the right to try.
Art Kaplan is a medical ethicist at NYU. Once a month, a recording studio in the basement of the Lawrence, Kansas Public Library opens its doors for a jam session. There are no guitars or drum sets, though. The music is made with motion-detecting computers that allow anybody to play. For one woman, these music sessions help give back some of what a brain injury has taken away. Alex Smith has her story.
In the movies, a coma is usually portrayed as a total lights out, a complete lack of awareness. But that's not at all what it was like for Julie Unruh. She was 19 in the late 90s when a car accident left her in a coma and changed her ability to communicate. She doesn't remember the accident or the 3 months she spent in a hospital bed, but she does remember music.
You know how when you're not really doing anything or like thinking of anything, like music will just come into your head, like you just think of a song and it'll be playing in your head.
Julie's an amateur musician, and to her surprise, the tunes that drifted up from her memory weren't the grungy guitar music she liked. She heard Beethoven.
I think my mind just automatically went there.
Julie says her restless brain seemed to be keeping busy by replaying music stored in her subconscious. The Eroica Symphony haunted her and became her companion during months in a fog.
Of course it was keeping me entertained, but then it was calming me, because that does calm me when you listen to Beethoven.
When Julie awoke, she found out she had suffered brain damage, which left her unable to walk or talk. She couldn't play her instruments, the flute and guitar. Today, 20 years after the coma, she's trying a different kind of music as part of her road of recovery.
First of all, welcome to the first Almy Jam of 2018. Woo.
Sherry Tucker teaches the history of improvisation in music at the University of Kansas. She welcomes a loose-knit group of community members, musicians, students, and people with disabilities to the Lawrence Library. They're here to try their hand at the Adaptive Use Musical Instrument, or AUMI.
How many people have used it before?
The AUMI is a free app for tablet computers. I've got it open in front of me right now. It tracks your motion and translates the motion into sound. It's tracking my chin or maybe my nose. I've got it set to play the sound of a glockenspiel, but it can play just about any instrument sound. There are weirder options too, like kittens or street sounds of Vietnam. Once the musicians get the basics of the AUMI figured out, they move into the studio. The engineer starts recording and the music begins. The music made at these sessions can be disjointed, chaotic, and noisy. But for the AUMI's most famous champion, the sessions were more about the process than the aesthetics. Pauline Oliveros explained her philosophy in a documentary.
I'm not interested in making an object of art and entertainment, but I'm interested in making something that helps me to grow and expand and change as an individual.
She made her mark in the 60s as an electronic music composer, but then shifted her focus to interactive musical workshops and projects. KU professor Sherry Tucker says that Pauline Oliveros held monthly AUMI sessions to give anyone the chance to become a composer.
She thought it was healing.
At a recent AUMI session, Julie, the woman who was in a coma 20 years ago, takes her turn in the studio. Music therapy has struggled for a place in the world of medicine. It's often not covered by insurance. But some newer research suggests music could be healing for the brain. One recent study shows playing musical instruments may improve cognitive impairment caused by brain injuries. The therapeutic effects of the AUMI haven't been studied, but Julie thinks it helps her. Not only that, but it puts a world of musical possibilities at her fingertips.
See, what's cool about AUMI is you can totally be like an orchestra all by yourself, an orchestra of one.
An orchestra of one. For The Pulse, I'm Alex Smith.
Alex is a reporter for public radio station KCUR in Kansas City. Let's meet a guy who's mostly given up eating, and instead he gets his nutrition from a bottle. Part of his motivation is saving time. The other big part is he thinks it's healthier. Alex Stern spent some time with him.
Here's what Christopher Henderson had for lunch.
All right, first one, filtered water. Maltodextrin, soy protein isolate, high oleic sunflower oil, isomaltulose, alkalized cocoa powder.
That's also what he had for breakfast and for dinner. It's called Soylent, and it's kind of the ultimate processed food. It's a meal replacement that comes in a bottle or a powder that you mix with water, and it's supposed to give you all the calories and the nutrients you need. Christopher calls himself a social eater. You know, like a social drinker, someone who only drinks at parties or when they're out with friends. He only eats when there's a specific occasion.
I definitely get really excited about social meals now.
The rest of his nutrition comes entirely from Soylent.
One bottle that I drink is about 400 calories and gives you 20% of your daily values based on a 2,000 calorie diet.
Can you tell me, like, what does it taste like?
So I tried all the flavors. The original, a lot of folks say that it tastes like the milk in your bowl after you've eaten cereal. To me, it has like a neutral taste, meaning like it's not great, but it's not terrible.
Is it okay if I try some?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm like vaguely nervous. Yeah, that's like exactly, it's like milk after Cheerios.
Soylent has a cult following among tech nerds and coders. They like it because it's efficient. You don't have to waste time that could be spent coding on things like cooking. That definitely appealed to Christopher. He's a computer and systems engineer and a gamer, the kind of guy whose favorite hobby is hacking different parts of his life. And he's not exactly a chef.
You know, I might burn down my house trying to boil a hot dog.
A lot of the time, he'd just end up eating junk food.
I'm always on the move in the morning, going to work, so it's probably Dunkin' Donuts or Wawa, to be honest.
Christopher was never terribly out of shape, but his eating habits weren't the best. So he decided to run a personal experiment. For a year, 80% of his meals would be Soylent. That's 4 or 5 bottles a day. He'd get a blood test before and after that year, and weigh himself regularly. I caught up with Christopher at the end of the experiment. He said it had taken some self-control at times, but that the convenience of chugging his dinner always won out.
The one thing that I've certainly kind of gotten from this diet is that when you start putting the things in your body really needs, that you overall feel more energetic and less lethargic after a meal.
Christopher also noticed a difference in his body. His weight used to fluctuate a lot, up to 30 pounds, but for the past year, it stayed consistent. He made an appointment with his doctor to talk about his lab results and go through the data.
Hey, how's it going, Dr. Price?
Good, sir.
Always the tech nerd, Christopher had arranged to do the appointment via video chat.
Oh, sorry, you lagged out there for a moment. What was that?
The average blood sugar is better than normal.
Excellent.
Yeah, the labs all look good.
Excellent. All right, cool.
You're a lean, mean machine.
Thanks.
Thank you for calling, sir.
So, technically speaking, the experiment is over. Are you going to keep drinking? Soylent?
Yep, that's pretty much the game plan. I mean, it fits my lifestyle really well. I'm really comfortable with it.
That's Christopher Henderson talking about his time-saving way of eating. Alex Stern produced this piece. Christopher did have a chat with his doctor before he started this experiment, and the doctor said, sure, give it a shot, and it looks like it's working for him. But nutritionists have some concerns about Soylent and similar drinks. One nutritionist told me that this doesn't teach people how to eat a healthy diet. They become too dependent on the drink. And she also mentioned that there are highly processed ingredients in these types of drinks, like artificial sweeteners. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about treating yourself, finding your own ways to get better, pushing for more options. Courtney Harris Bond is a reporter and a mom who has been dealing with depression most of her life. Recently, her mood got worse, nothing seemed to work, and eventually she decided to try a totally different approach to treating her illness.
Mood disorders run like a sticky red tape through my family's history. So it's not surprising that I began my battle with anxiety and depression as a little girl. I got help from a child psychiatrist, but when I finally left home for college, away from my support network, I quickly unraveled. I ended up attempting suicide and was in a psych hospital for 4 months. Since then, a combination of therapy and medication has kept me on my feet. I've tried close to 15 different medications over the past 25 years. Unfortunately, I've either had adverse reactions or the medication lost its effectiveness over time. But nothing prepared me for the plunge I took last fall. I became desperately depressed and started thinking about suicide. I stopped working, and my in-laws and husband took care of our three kids. Then one of my doctors suggested a treatment I had never heard of, transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. TMS is non-invasive. It's done in an outpatient setting. A magnetic coil that produces pulsing energy is suspended over selected parts of the scalp to stimulate neuron activity in parts of the brain involved in mood regulation. The success rate for patients who haven't been helped by medications is between 50 and 75%. That sounded promising, so I signed on. I ended up consulting with psychiatrist John O'Riordan, who helped pioneer this treatment more than two decades ago. At the first session, he told me that even though I felt hopeless, I was not a hopeless case. I had never had somebody tell me before that I could get fully well.
Right.
So it was like a real eye-opener when I came in here and you talked about remission and things like that. Yeah.
What's interesting that you say that, I think it speaks to some degree to under-treatment in the community that is not always treated intensely enough. I don't guess maybe people don't think about it that way. Well, we should think about it as a reversible illness. It should be more like treating hypertension or diabetes. If you have the right tools, you should be able to reverse things fully and get back to a normal balance. Now, we don't always achieve that, but you've got to start with that goal in mind. Okay, and that's just right.
The first thing I do at every appointment is put on a cap that Dr. O'Riordan has carefully marked.
The cap needs to be just in place. We have spots on the cap where we previously located your prefrontal cortex on the left and on the right. This is making sure the cap is in the correct alignment.
So you're just putting me back in the chair now?
Yeah, just get you into the best comfortable position for placing the magnet. And this magnet, it doesn't look like a huge magnet, but it's actually as powerful as an MRI. So it is very, very potent.
So I am just lying here now and having my TMS session, and I'm very relaxed. It doesn't hurt. Just feels like a hard tapping on my head, very rapid, but not in a painful way.
One of the benefits of TMS is that it has almost no side effects.
You don't have bugbears like sedation, nausea, weight gain, sexual dysfunction you have with meds. But to be fair, on the other hand, it's very easy to take a medication, whereas TMS is more time intensive for everybody.
About a month into my treatment, I started to notice that I was having ideas about work again. I was also enjoying more moments with my children. I felt like I was ascending a staircase back into the world. By the end of 30 sessions, I felt more positive, more resilient, and more hopeful than I had in years.
Most health insurance companies now cover TMS as a treatment for depression and some other mental health conditions. Courtney Harris-Bond reported this piece with support from the Scattergood Foundation. We're talking about the things people will do to treat themselves, how far they'll go. I asked people about that on social media. Here's one of the stories I got back.
My name is Gerald Sveinbilgen.
Gerald is a sailor, and he was working on a boat in Connecticut, cutting some wood.
On my lap, there was an oscillating saw. The saw fell down, and the blade dug itself into my foot, causing a 2-inch wide cut. So I took some duct tape, made butterflies out of them, and taped the wound shut.
He says he got a scar from this, but otherwise his foot is fine. I also heard from somebody who tried to unclog his ears with a shop vac. The list just goes on and on. There's a new podcast coming out this summer. It's called The Workaround. It's all about the lengths people go to get the help they need. It's from Side Effects Public Media, and joining us now is one of the reporters for this podcast, Bram Sable-Smith. Hey, Bram.
Hi, Maiken.
It seems like a lot of people treat themselves or look for alternative options because of cost, because healthcare can be really expensive, and that's something you know about personally.
It is. It is something I know about personally. I have diabetes, type 1 diabetes, which means my body doesn't make insulin, so I need manufactured insulin every day for the rest of my life.
To regulate your blood sugar and to stay alive, so how much does that cost you?
The list price on a single vial of insulin is about $275. I use two vials a month, so do the math, $550 a month, and that's just for insulin. That doesn't include the cost of other supplies I need. Needles, pumps, blood sugar test strips.
But you have insurance, right?
I do have insurance. Pretty good insurance, too. But even with that pretty good insurance, I'm still paying around $200 a month out of pocket. That's every month. And the trouble is, lots of Americans don't have insurance. So one of the people I met while reporting for this podcast is Nicole Smith Holt. She's from Minneapolis. Her son Alec had type 1 diabetes, and just about a year ago, he was turning 26, which meant he needed to figure out what to do about insurance because he was aging out. He could no longer be on his mom's health plan.
He was making $35 a year. That was his salary. So it was too much to qualify for the Affordable Care Act. So we were looking at, they have a marketplace for private insurance. And what we were finding was just ridiculous. But what we did find was running about $450 a month with a deductible of $7,600.
So he would have had to spend $7,600 before his insurance would even kick in.
That's right. And that's in addition to the $450 a month premium. That's the bill you have to pay just to get health coverage in the first place. Alec's diabetes supplies cost about $1,300 a month. And Nicole says that put her son in an impossible situation.
So he was like, well, you know, either I pay $1,300 a month for my, you know, insulin and supplies, or I pay $1,300 a month for my insulin supplies plus the $400 a month premium. It's like, well, duh, I'm going with the out-of-pocket, $1,300 a month. So that's what he decided.
So he went without insurance?
He went without insurance. He decided it would be cheaper. He turned 26 on May 20th last year. On June 1st, he got booted off his mother's insurance. And on June 27th, 3 days before payday, he ran out of insulin.
The official date of death is June 27th. So 27 days after losing my insurance, he lost his life. He didn't even get to go to the pharmacy one time to pay the $1,300 out of pocket. He was still using his insulin from the month before.
Was he trying to ration the insulin he had?
That's what they think. Before his body got taken away from his apartment, his sisters walked through it to see him and to look around, and they found empty vials of insulin.
And the price of insulin has been going up, even though insulin has been around for quite some time, right?
So one of the largest makers of insulin is the pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly, and they're actually the first people who brought insulin to market back in the 1920s. And actually, the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, was a top executive at Eli Lilly from 2012 until he joined the Trump administration. And while he was at Eli Lilly, the price for insulin more than doubled. Right now, the Trump administration says it's working to lower drug prices overall, but the high price tag has some people taking matters into their own hands.
Yeah, these stories, thankfully, few of them end as tragically as Alex's story, but people all over the country are struggling with the cost of insulin.
That's exactly right. And all you have to do to see that is go to the crowdfunding site GoFundMe, and there you'll find hundreds of campaigns of people trying to raise the money to get the insulin, just a one-month supply of insulin.
So where do we go from here? Is anything happening to push for more affordable insulin to bring the price down?
Well, the Trump administration has talked a lot about drug pricing recently, but there's not a lot of tangibles yet, especially not for insulin. But there is a budding social media movement. Their hashtag is Insulin for All, and I call them Diabetes Twitter. And that's actually how I found Nicole Smith Holt. And people, activists like Nicole, they want the cost of insulin to be lower so that everyone can afford it. Here she is telling a crowd outside of the Eli Lilly building about her son's death.
On his death certificate, the official cause of death is DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis. The unofficial cause of death was slipping through the cracks of our broken healthcare system and corporate greed. Healthcare is a human right, health is a human right, and insulin is a human right.
And in Minnesota, Alex Smith's name is on a bill that would provide emergency insulin and diabetes supplies for low-income people. And as politicians and advocates across the nation talk about drug pricing, Alex's name and his story, it's a part of that conversation.
And Bram, the rest of your reporting on insulin prices will be on the Workaround podcast, which is coming out this summer. I look forward to hearing it. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Life has been hard in Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria struck the island. The destruction was vast. So many people lost their homes. In the wake of all that devastation, public health officials warned that Puerto Rico was experiencing a mental health crisis. Calls to suicide hotlines skyrocketed, and people showed signs of post-traumatic stress. In the tiny town of Mariana in eastern Puerto Rico, some residents found comfort in community. Power has been out since September, but a group of women gathers every day to cook and to feed their neighbors. Irina Zhorov spent time with them.
Matilde Colon rode out the storm with family. On the morning after Hurricane Maria, she learned that the winds had destroyed her wooden house. When she went to see it, her world fell apart.
La nevera por un lado.
The fridge over here,
la estufa por otro, la
stove over there,
cama es barata,
the beds and bureaus wrecked.
Yo quedé sin nada.
She lost everything. She moved in with her son in a little town about a half hour from her home, and she became really, really depressed. She says she went to see a psychologist. Then, she met some other women in a similar situation.
We all live by ourselves. I live by myself, she lives by herself.
Maria Lavoy points at the elegant women, hair done, eyebrows painted, bustling around her in a busy kitchen.
She lives by herself, she lives by herself. And she lives by herself.
They're in their 60s, 70s, 80s. Most lost something during the storm. After the hurricane, about seven of them started gathering in the town's Hilltop Community Center, which has an industrial kitchen. Usually, the kitchen is used for an annual festival. But after the storm, a group of activists turned it into a community eatery, putting the women to work serving food every day. A month after the women started cooking, the kitchen got upgraded with donated solar panels and a big battery to power it. The group's day starts early.
We come every day here at 8 o'clock, and then we cook until like 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
What is that?
Chicken.
This is brother chicken.
As she weaves between the women in colorful aprons, wielding spatulas and plates, Maria stuffs some chicken in my mouth.
It's good.
Mm-hmm. You want to eat?
Mm-mm. No, I have to work.
Okay.
The chicken is juicy and crunchy. Each woman has her specialty. Carmen Margarita says she likes to make the beans and chickpeas and attends to people when they arrive.
Nosotros comenzamos llevándole comida a las personas encamadas.
Maria Martinez says at first they delivered the food to bedridden and sick people, like her own daughter, who broke her leg in a fall during the storm. Community members without power at home started showing up, sometimes hundreds per day, and they fed them. Then the women started feeding volunteers from the mainland, who'd arrived to help with various projects. On this day, Salvation Army had dropped off boxes of food and diapers, so the little mountaintop was teeming with people.
Today, I cooked the rice, dos veces, for too many people today.
She cooked two batches.
We get together. Instead of being in the home lonely and by yourself and depressed, we just spend the day here. We laugh.
Maria Lavoy says they laugh, they argue, they make up.
It's nice. You don't need a psychologist, you don't need a therapist, you don't need nothing because we have it here. And it's like, this is like a therapy for us.
Maria translates what she's saying to the others. And they nod. Mathilde Colon, who lost her house, says they've become sisters. She feels good.
Ahora me siento bien, gracias a Dios.
As the lunch hour wraps up, the women scrape pots clean for the next day's work. They're the most enthusiastic, coordinated, and efficient group of workers I've ever seen. After Maria, their sense of community is something worth singing about.
Irina Zhurov reported the story during her recent travels to Puerto Rico. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Our intern is Mike Mascarelli. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports The Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.